who will be speaking to us today on Ramanujan and the Zeta function.
Well, let me begin by thanking the organizers for the invitation to speak at this conference. This is an interesting topic for various reasons. It concerns Ramanujan's contributions to our knowledge of the special values of the Riemann zeta function, of which very little is known. So let me begin with a historical introduction. The first person to seriously investigate the zeta function is Euler, who in 1735 discovered experimentally that the sum of the reciprocals of the squares sums up to pi squared over 6. This is certainly a profound example of the power of experimental mathematics, but of course he didn't have computers, he did the whole thing by hand. And he gave a rigorous proof of this in 1742, much later. And I put the word rigorous in quotation marks because if you analyze the proof very carefully, you'll find that it's not rigorous. So here's a sketch of Euler's proof. Euler was very much anti-Bourbaki in the sense that rigor really didn't play an important role in his early part of his research. He was motivated more by analogy, and one of the beautiful examples of this power of analogy is the simple observation that if you have a polynomial with roots R1 to Rn, I'm writing my polynomial in this fashion. I hope this screen is visible to the people in Vancouver, because I'm just going to be pointing there. So these are the roots, and if you have, the roots are equal to R1 to Rn. And the simple observation is that when you expand the polynomial, the coefficient of x is just simply the negative of the reciprocals of the roots, yes. So a polynomial is determined by its roots, and knowing its roots is the same as knowing the polynomial. And now he made a leap of the imagination, which is very powerful in science. Suppose sine pi x behaves like a polynomial, and sine pi x has a Taylor expansion. It has roots at 0, plus or minus 1, and plus or minus 2, and so on and so forth. And if you put the define the function f of x to be sine pi x by pi x, L'Hopital's rule tells us that f of 0 is 1. And now f of x has roots at plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, and so forth. And now perhaps we can factor this function as a polynomial and write it as 1 minus x, 1 plus x, and so forth. And now making the observation, grouping together plus and minus of the roots, you see that it's equal to 1 minus x squared, 1 minus x squared over 4, and so forth. And now getting back to the observation that the coefficient of x squared on the right-hand side is negative of the reciprocals of the squares, we find that comparing coefficients gives us that summation 1 over n squared is pi squared over 6. Now, can this proof be justified? The leap of the imagination is treating sine pi x as a polynomial. And the first person who actually justified that proof is Jacques Hadamard. Euler's proof can be made rigorous by using Hadamard's theory of factorization of entire functions, a theory developed by Hadamard in his 1892 doctoral thesis. Now, Euler's proof can be generalized. To what extent? Can we evaluate, for example, summation 1 over n cubed or summation 1 over n to the fourth by this technique? Well, as we all know, Euler had trouble with summation 1 over n cubed and the odd powers, but for the even powers, he managed to show that they were always powers of pi times a rational number. For example, summation 1 over n to the fourth comes up neatly to be pi to the 4 divided by 90, and in general, zeta 2k turns out to be pi to the 2k times a rational number. Now, if we modify Euler's proof, we can actually prove these things. Let f of x be as before, sine pi x over pi x. Now plug in f of change x to ix, I being square root of minus 1. And multiplying these two together gives us 1 minus x to the fourth, 1 minus x to the fourth over 2 to the fourth, and this time you have the fourth powers of the natural numbers as the roots, and the Taylor expansion of f of x and f of ix is equal to the obvious thing. And when you multiply this together, compare coefficients, you end up getting that summation 1 over n to the fourth is pi to the fourth over 90. Let me, for the benefit of any undergraduates in the room, let me just tell you what an algebraic number is. An algebraic number is a number which is a root of a monic polynomial with rational coefficients, and a number which is not algebraic is called transcendental. So algebraic numbers form a countable set, and so the set of transcendental numbers is uncountable. So numbers such as square root of 3 or the 7th root of 2, 1 plus square root 5 over 2 are all algebraic numbers, and numbers like pi and e are transcendental numbers. And the set of algebraic numbers forms a field under addition and multiplication. So that's a nice thing about algebraic numbers. Not so with the transcendental numbers. In this talk, we will be interested if zeta k is an algebraic number or a transcendental number for all natural numbers. Here, zeta is the Riemann zeta function. So let me tell you a little bit about the Riemann zeta function. Here is a picture of Riemann. He didn't have a long life, as you can see, born in 1826 and died in 1866. But he did a lot of mathematics, so he lives on. Zeta s is summation 1 over n to the s, and it converges and defines a well-defined analytic function for real part s bigger than 1. And using the theory of theta functions, Riemann managed to give an analytic continuation of this function to the entire complex plane and established a functional equation, which is essentially a consequence of the Poisson summation formula. So if you put psi of s to be pi to the minus s over 2, gamma s over 2 zeta s, you have a nice functional equation, psi of s equal to psi of 1 minus s. Here, gamma s is the gamma function defined by the integral from 0 to infinity of e to the minus t to the s minus 1 dt for real part of s bigger than 0. And because gamma s plus 1 has a nice functional equation, which tells us that it's gamma s plus 1 is equal to s times gamma of s, you can analytically continue the gamma function using that functional equation to the entire complex plane. So this is a beautiful piece of mathematics, his only paper in number theory, in which he outlined the importance of this function to the prime number theorem. So in the same paper, Riemann indicated, but did not prove, how this zeta function can be used to prove theorems about prime numbers. More precisely, he indicated a program for proving the prime number theorem originally conjectured by Gauss, that the number of primes p of x up to x is asymptotic to x by log x as x tends to infinity. And the formal proof was given by Hadamard and de La Vallée-Poussin in 1896. They proved independently the prime number theorem, and Hadamard had to develop theory of entire functions, Hadamard products, and show that the Riemann zeta function had such a product, and exploiting the properties of that product was able to show the prime number theorem. It's interesting, there's a historical anecdote that goes with this. The Riemann hypothesis, which I will talk to you about, was claimed to have proved by Stelzius around the same time, and in his modest paper written by Hadamard in the Compte Rendu, Hadamard writes, I will prove a modest result that the Riemann zeta function does not vanish on the line real part s equals 1, because Stelzius had obviously announced the proof of the Riemann hypothesis, which of course has been taken back. The zeros of the Riemann zeta function are mysterious. In their proof of the prime number theorem, Hadamard and de La Vallée-Poussin showed that zeta doesn't vanish on the line real part s equals 1, and that was sufficient to deduce the prime number theorem. And in the paper that I mentioned earlier, Riemann conjectured that if the zeta function vanished inside the critical region, real part s lying between 0 and 1, then necessarily the real part of the 0 has to be a half. And this is called the Riemann hypothesis, and to this day it is still an open problem. As of 2004, maybe it's been already superseded, but as of 2004, Gordon and DeMichel checked that the first 10 to the 13 zeros are indeed on the line real part s equals a half. It's quite a powerful numerical evidence for this fact. Here are some other mysteries of the zeta function. Well, the Riemann hypothesis, I already mentioned that. What about the growth rate of the zeta function on the critical line? The growth rate is conjectured to be t to the epsilon. This is called the Lindelof hypothesis. It's still open. It's a consequence of the Riemann hypothesis. And what about special values like zeta 2, zeta 3? Well, zeta 2 we already talked about. Zeta 2 is pi squared over 6. What about zeta 3? Well, Euler's theorem tells us zeta 2k is... ignore the 2 that appears there, that's supposed to be an element of, and sometimes with PowerPoint, fonts change from computer to computer. So zeta 2k is an element of pi to the 2k times a rational number. I hope more messes won't occur. Euler proved a more precise theorem. If you define the Bernoulli numbers as the Taylor coefficients of x over e to the x minus 1, then the BNs are all rational numbers, as is easily seen. And Euler actually proved that zeta 2k is pi to the 2k times this Bernoulli number, b2k, 2 to the 2k over 2k factorial. So since pi is a transcendental number, we see that all the zeta 2k's are transcendental for every k bigger than or equal to 1. Now, what about zeta 3? Apéry surprised the world in 1979 by showing that zeta 3 is an irrational number. It was a surprise. His starting point was the following remarkable formula, that zeta 3 can be given as a rapidly convergent series, and he exploited this rapid convergence using the theory of continued fractions in a brilliant sort of way and forced the irrationality of zeta 3. There are many conjectures concerning the values zeta 3, zeta 5, and so forth. One expects that zeta 3, zeta 5 are all transcendental numbers. One expects that they're all algebraically independent. And in fact, they're all algebraically independent of pi. In the year 2000, Rivol proved that infinitely many of the numbers zeta 2k plus 1 are irrational. And in 2001, Rivol and Zudlin showed that at least one of the numbers, zeta 5, zeta 7, zeta 9, zeta 11, is irrational. And later on, together with Ball, they showed that the Q vector space spanned by zeta 3, zeta 5, and so forth, up to zeta A, is, I actually wrote down something incorrect here. What is written is correct, but there was a more precise theorem that they proved that the dimension of the space spanned by zeta 3, zeta 5, up to zeta A, is at least log A by log 2 or some constant thereof. Now I want to come to Ramanujan's formula. Here is Ramanujan's formula. It's a picture of Ramanujan, who also lived a very short life. So Ramanujan discovered the following formula for zeta 3. Zeta 3 plus summation 1 over n cubed times e to the 2 pi n minus 1 is 7 pi cubed over 180. So this rapidly convergent series is introduced in order to evaluate the expression. So one can conclude that at least one of the numbers, zeta 3 or that funny series, is transcendental. And in this talk, I'd like to focus on the funny series. I can't say anything about the zeta 3, so I'd like to say something non-trivial about the funny series. So here's the page of Ramanujan's notebook where the formula appears. I hope you guys can read that. It's the first five lines of this notebook. The notebooks, by the way, these are not to be confused with the lost notebooks of Ramanujan. These are the found notebooks. They were published in 1957 by the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research as two voluminous notebooks, and it was just more or less Xeroxing every page of his notebook. And Bruce Berndt has done us a great service by taking these notebooks and writing five more notebooks. They're now published by Springer, analyzing each of the formulas in Ramanujan's notebook. So it's very handy to have Bruce Berndt's commentary on these notebooks to investigate these formulas. At least I found it very useful to consult Bruce Berndt's works. If you couldn't see that formula, here it is again. So it's a formula which relates zeta 2n plus 1 plus this funny series with the Bernoulli numbers. And here alpha and beta are positive real numbers with the property that alpha beta has to be pi squared. I forgot to write that condition down, but more like alpha beta has to be pi squared. So it's a very general formula giving us what zeta 2n plus 1 is with respect to these funny series. Now, what's interesting is mathematicians keep rediscovering beautiful things independently, and this is no exception. Emil Groswald, I think as part of his PhD thesis, if I'm not mistaken, may have had written a paper proving the following theorem. Suppose you set R2k plus 1 of z to be this polynomial constructed out of the Bernoulli numbers. Is that clear to you people? Okay, because it's kind of fuzzy to me. Maybe I'm standing too closely. This is a polynomial defined by the Bernoulli numbers. If you can't read it, I'll read it out for you. B2j, B2k plus 2 minus 2j, over 2j factorial, 2k plus 2 minus 2j factorial, times z to the 2k plus 2 minus 2j. Very simple looking polynomial. And now define the function sigma sub k of n, which to be the sum of the kth powers of the divisors of n, and set f sub k of n to be sigma k of n over n to the k e to the 2 pi I and z. Looks like the Eisenstein series, but the Eisenstein series doesn't have an n to the k at the bottom. It's just sigma k of n e to the 2 pi nz. So this is a funny modification of the Eisenstein series. And consider this function for imaginary part of z positive, so where z is in the upper half plane. Then Groswald showed that f sub 2k plus 1 of z minus z to the 2k f 2k plus 1 minus 1 over z is actually equal to 1 half zeta 2k plus 1 times the z to the 2k minus 1 plus this pi to 2k plus 1 times this polynomial. I'm going to call this r sub 2k plus 1 the Ramanujan polynomial, because if you put z equal to I alpha in the Groswald's formula and make an observation that sigma k of n over n to the k e to the 2 pi n alpha is basically this funny series that Ramanujan had, you end up re-deriving Ramanujan's formula. So Ramanujan's formula is a special case of the Groswald formula evaluated as a purely imaginary argument. But something more is interesting. The values of f sub ki alpha are examples of what are called Eichler integrals. So in essence, what Ramanujan is saying is that the difference of two Eichler integrals is related to zeta 2k plus 1. That's what's going on. And now you start seeing periods entering and some geometric ideas entering the picture. So Groswald's formula opens up new possible expressions for zeta 2k plus 1. Indeed, I'm sorry I'm not flashing the previous screen, but if you remember what the previous screen said, it basically said that these two Eichler integrals is equal to zeta 2k plus 1 times z to the 2k minus 1 plus the Ramanujan polynomial at z. So if I can find a zero of the Ramanujan polynomial, which is not a 2kth root of unity, then you actually get an expression of zeta 2k plus 1 as a difference of two Euler integrals. So that opens up a new research problem to figure out where are the zeros of the Ramanujan polynomials. So I gave this as a problem for my summer NSERC undergraduate research student. What do they call it? Undergraduate summer research student, USRA or something. Rob Wang, very sharp guy. And I told him, please compute the Ramanujan polynomials and find out where all the zeros are, as far as you can go. So this is a conference on experimental number theory. I thought this was perfect for the occasion. So he calculated, cranked away all these polynomials and started finding some remarkably interesting patterns. In the first case, you could do this by hand. The first polynomial has roots plus or minus I. The second polynomial has these roots plus or minus 2 point something and plus or minus 0.4. So they're all real roots. The second polynomial, R3, has all real roots. The fifth polynomial, so these are all indexed by odd numbers. The fifth polynomial, all of a sudden, has four real roots plus or minus I. Okay, so always seems to be four real roots, and everything else is non-real, but they not only are non-real, but they seem to be lying on the unit circle. As you can see for the next one, again, the roots are real, and the roots are always on the unit circle. So here's more impressive numerical data. You keep on cranking it out. You find that the next polynomial also has four real roots floating around, and all the other roots seem to be lying on the unit circle in the upper half plane. I hope you guys can read all this. So there they are. So notice that for each k, R sub 2k plus 1 of z seems to possess exactly four real roots. Furthermore, the largest of the real roots is always less than or equal to 2.2, and it seems to be approaching 2 as k increases. On the other hand, the complex roots seem to lie on the exactly on the unit circle. So here's the theorem we could prove. Well, all the zeros of the Ramanujan polynomial indeed lie in mod z less than 2.2. The real zeros of R2k plus 1 are 4 in number, so that we can prove. Descartes' rule of signs, actually. Very simple. Then these roots seem to be approaching 2 and minus 2, half and minus a half. Well, the fact that plus or minus the roots is because the polynomial of even degree. That's clear. The other fact is that if z is a root, minus 1 over z is also a root simply because of the functional equation, that symmetry of the coefficients. That's clear too. But then, okay, when k is even, R sub 2k plus 1 of z has plus or minus I as zeros. Now, in some sense, Ramanujan knew this because plus or minus I is a purely imaginary number, and he actually knew when that thing was vanishing. But if he only had changed the argument to an arbitrary complex number, I'm sure he would have found something interesting else happens, especially that the cube roots of unity are also zeros when 3 divides k, and actually that can be proved. He found this experimentally. It's one of these nice situations, and I was trying to figure out why in the world this is going to be the case, but it turns out that there's a nice theoretical reason for it. So our conjecture is that all the non-real zeros of R sub 2k plus 1 of z lie on the unit circle, and they don't seem to be 2kth roots of unity. Remember, if it's a 2kth root of unity, you're in trouble because that wipes out zeta 2k plus 1 in that Ramanujan's formula. So it's very important that it's not. And so it seems to be, the conjecture, therefore, that we're going to make is that zeta 2k plus 1 can always be written as the difference of two Euler integrals. That's our conjecture. And it seems to, we've proved it up to small cases. So here are some transcendence results that can be garnered from this investigation. if you let Ek of z to be the classical Eisenstein series that all of you are familiar with, the coefficient of the Eisenstein series is sigma sub k minus 1 of n. If you want to relate it back to that Fk of z that Grosvold introduced in order to generalize Ramanujan's formula, basically what you're doing is you're taking Ek plus 1, taking off the constant term, and then integrating it against a polynomial. And this is really what's called an Eichler integral of the first kind. Now, here's a report on some recent work with Shaoli Gun and Purushottam Roth of the Chennai Mathematical Institute and the Institute for Mathematical Sciences in Chennai. Let k be a non-negative integer. And with at most 2k plus 3 exceptions, the value of f2k plus 1 of alpha minus alpha to the 2k f2k plus 1 minus 1 over alpha is transcendental for every algebraic alpha in the upper half plane. In other words, there are at most 2k plus 3 algebraic numbers lying in the upper half plane such that both of these Eichler integrals are algebraic. So the transcendental nature of Eichler integrals becomes of interest because it's been related to the value of the zeta function. And so one would like to say something specific about a given Eichler integral. And this is as best as we can do, given the state of knowledge at the moment. Now, the funny thing is, in mathematics, I guess most people don't read papers. Grosvold, when he wrote his paper, I believe he... when he wrote his paper, he didn't know of Ramanujan's work. And if you look in the edition of Göttinger Nachrichten where the paper appeared, there's a footnote at the end of the paper that says, Carl Ludwig Siegel just told me that this formula appears in Ramanujan's notebooks. Fortunately, Grosvold had generalized it to an arbitrary complex number as opposed to purely, you know, but more or less the idea that. And by 1973, of course, Grosvold saw a general pattern, and the general pattern is more general than one could think of. You start with an element, an element, what's called a generic element in the Selberg class. So a generic element in the Selberg class will be a generalized Dirichlet series with some sort of a functional equation, Euler product. So you start with something like this. Let delta of S be the product of gamma functions. And let's, now, I hope this font is not too small. Oh, darn it. Okay, sorry. See, I found a new way of cheating in PowerPoint without actually teching anything. That is, you create a PDF file, and you take a snapshot of parts of your paper, and then you stick it into the PowerPoint. So I think when I did that, I didn't check how big the font is, so I'm sorry if this is too small. But anyway, let me read it out for the people here and the people in Vancouver as well, because it's too far to see. So let phi of S be a Dirichlet series, a generalized Dirichlet series, an e to the minus lambda n over S. I guess there's a mistake, there's a typo, it's a e to the minus lambda n. Suppose you have an arbitrary functional equation, phi of S relating it to phi of tau minus S, and define f of z to be this kind of funny Mellon transform. And Grosvold shows that the residues of this Mellon of this integral, which he defines as f of u, can be related in the following way. So these residues that appear, maybe here's my laser pointer, these residues that appear in these formulas are related back to f prime of I and f of I and f of I. And notice what we have here is f of minus 1 over z related to something f of z equaling the sum of the residues. So it's looking like a generalized version of the Ramanujan Grosvold formula. And indeed, it is the case that if you apply this general theorem of Grosvold for the Selberg class to a particular function, phi of s to be zeta of s times zeta of s plus 2k plus 1, and crank the machine through, it satisfies a nice functional equation, and crank the machine through and unravel what it is that Grosvold has proved in this case, you find immediately the Ramanujan formula again. Now this opens up a new line of investigation. Now that we've taken this Ramanujan formula and put it as part of a spectral lines of a whole galaxy of formulas. And so the next level of complexity after the Riemann zeta function or classical Dirichlet series are the L functions arising from modular forms. So it is natural to consider L series attached to modular forms and see what's going on. Well, surely enough, people got this idea. Hecke actually had this idea somewhat. André Weil writes a paper in 1976, totally oblivious of the paper by Groswald. The classical paper is called, what is it? Hecke's Lemma and Its Use. It's a beautiful paper, but there he shows, he rediscovers Ramanujan's formula in the context of modular forms. So he says, if I start, and then this was again, of course, Goldstein and Rosar knew about Weil's paper, but they didn't know about the Groswald paper. Start off with functions f of z and g of z, and write down, so I hope this is visible, write down these objects, f star and g star. Notice what these are again. These are like Euler integrals. You've integrated these things against the cusp, some cusp, and then now evaluating it. Now, so now let phi of s be the Dirichlet series attached to this thing, and now assume that there's a general functional equation of this shape, which occurs in the classical theory of modular forms. Then you end up writing down a formula. F star of z minus something g star of minus 1 over z is equal to phi of k minus 1 minus j times these powers of 2 pi I and z to the j. What is phi? Phi is the Dirichlet series that's attached to the original modular form you started with. And so the special values of the modular form that you have started out with appear on the right-hand side along with these pi, and then you have these difference of two Euler integrals again. So this is the modular generalization of Ramanujan's formula. Can we find, so making these observations, can you get a new result on transcendence? And indeed, we can. So let's leave a picture of my collaborators. Let F be a normalized Hecke eigenform of level n. Following the theory of Euler, Shimura, and Manin, we know that there are two periods that you can associate, omega plus and omega minus, such that the special value of the L function at j that occurs for the j that occurs in the right-hand side of that formula that we had on the previous slide, those j's are the Dillon's critical values. So they're really in the critical strip. They're the right things. So for those things, the special value of the L function turns out to be a power of pi times an omega plus or minus, times a rational number. And it is perhaps true, and this is, I believe it's not known, that the numbers pi, omega plus, and omega minus are algebraically independent. Now, if one accepts general conjectures of Grothendieck in this matter, that is a fact. But I believe this is a part of a larger picture on the conjecture on transcendence of periods, algebraic independence of periods that Grothendieck has made. So now the theorem that we were able to show is that if you have a normalized Hecke eigenform of weight k and level n, suppose that these pi, omega plus, and omega minus are algebraically independent, then there are at most k algebraic values of z in the upper half plane, such that the difference of these two Euler integrals is algebraic. Now, that's the theorem we could prove. What can you deduce from this? Here's the case k equals 2 where something becomes interesting. In the case k equals 2, the right-hand side is constant, and it turns out to be equal to phi of 1 times this lambda over 2 pi I. And the left-hand side is f star of z minus, well, there shouldn't be this k is 2, right? So why is that? Is this fuzzy to you? Well, okay, it's fuzzy. Okay, I thought something was funny with this thing. So it's not in focus when it's cut and paste, I guess. Now, it turns out that these f star and g star are given by these Euler integrals. And finally, you get an interesting theorem by applying the theorem of Bertrand. Bertrand quite separately showed that if you have a normalized Hecke eigenform of weight 2 on gamma naught of n, and you look at a tau, which is either a cusp, a rational number, or an element in the upper half plane such that the J of tau is algebraic, then any determination of this integral, 2 pi I times integral f of z up to tau, is either zero or transcendental. Now, the fact of the matter is that integral is exactly one of these Eichler integrals we've been dealing with. You kind of undo a little bit of what I said on the previous slide, and it leads to an interesting corollary in our setting. So if you have a normalized Hecke eigenform of weight 2 on gamma naught of n, then the value of the L function divided by pi at the central point, you see the modular form is of weight 2, so it has a functional equation relating s to 2 minus s. The central point, or whatever you want to call it, the Birch-Schroeder Dyer point, in the case of an elliptic curve, of course, we know the value is conjectured to be period of an elliptic curve times various things. But in general, I believe this is new. If you take a modular form of weight 2, take the central value and divide it by pi, it's either 0 or transcendental. That's what you can get by putting all this together. A more general theorem is if you take a normalized Hecke eigenform of weight k and ask yourself, what is this thing that you have, f of z, and then you're relating it to f of minus 1 over z. Well, that's basically what you've done is you've applied this involution, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, on gamma naught of 1 or SL2z. You've hit it with that and seeing what's happening on the other side. So more generally, you could take an arbitrary element in gamma naught of n, take your Eichler integral and hit it with the sigma, and then show that these things take on at most k plus 3 algebraic values as z ranges over the algebraic numbers lying in the upper half plane. So here's a summary. The Ramanujan-Grosvold formula gives us the value of zeta 2k plus 1 as an algebraic linear combination of pi to the 2k plus 1 and a sum of two Eichler integrals evaluated at algebraic points in the upper half plane. If our conjecture concerning the location of zeros of the Ramanujan polynomial is correct, and if in addition these zeros are not 2k roots of unity, as numerical evidence seems to suggest, then one can deduce that zeta 2k plus 1 is actually a sum of two Eichler integrals evaluated at certain algebraic numbers lying on the unit circle in the upper half plane. That's it. Voila.